It was Tui's eyes, thought Keating, that put him at ease. There was such a vast understanding in Tui's eyes, and such an unfastidious kindness. No, what a word to think of! Such an unlimited kindness. It was as if one could hide nothing from him. But it was not necessary to hide it, because he would forgive anything. They were the most unaccusing eyes that Keating had ever seen. "But, Mr. Tui," he muttered, "I did want to—"
"You wanted to thank me for my article," said Tui, and made a little grimace of gay despair. "And here I've been trying so hard to prevent you from doing it. Do let me get away with it, won't you? There's no reason why you should thank me, if you happen to deserve the things I said. Well, the credit belongs to you, not to me. Doesn't it? But I was so happy that you thought I'm a great architect. But surely, my boy, you knew that. Or weren't you quite sure?" "Never quite sure of it."
"Well, I—" It was only a second's pause, and it seemed to Keating that this pause was all Tui had wanted to hear from him. Tui did not wait for the rest, but spoke as if he had received a full answer, and an answer that pleased him.
"And as for the Cosmo Slotnick building, who can deny that it's an extraordinary achievement? You know, I was greatly intrigued by its plan. It's a most ingenious plan, a brilliant plan, very unusual, quite different from what I have observed in your previous work, isn't it?"
"Naturally," said Keating, his voice clear and hard for the first time. "The problem was different from anything I'd done before, so I worked out that plan to fit the particular requirements of the problem."
"Of course," said Tui, gently. "A beautiful piece of work. You should be proud of it."
Keating noticed that Tui's eyes stood centered in the middle of the lenses, and the lenses stood focused straight on his pupils. And Keating knew suddenly that Tui knew he had not designed the plan of the Cosmo Slotnick building. This did not frighten him. What frightened him was that he saw approval in Tui's eyes.
"If you must feel—" "No, not gratitude. Gratitude is such an embarrassing word. But shall we say appreciation?" Tui continued,
and his voice had grown softer, as if Keating were a fellow conspirator who would know that the words used were to be, from now on, a code for a private meaning.
"You might thank me for understanding the symbolic implications of your building, and for stating them in words as you stated them in marble, since, of course, you were not just a common mason, but a thinker in stone."
"Yes," said Keating. "That was my abstract theme when I designed the building, the great masses and the flowers of culture. I've always believed that true culture springs from the common man, but I had no hope that anyone would ever understand me." Tui smiled. His thin lips slid open. His teeth showed. He was not looking at Keating. He was looking down at his own hand, the long, slender, sensitive hand of a concert pianist, moving a sheet of paper on the desk. Then he said,
"Perhaps we're brothers of the spirit, Keating, the human spirit. That is all that matters in life."
Not looking at Keating, but past him, the lenses raised flagrantly to a line over Keating's face. And Keating knew that Tui knew he had never thought of any abstract theme until he'd read that article, and more, that Tui approved again. When the lenses moved slowly to Keating's face, the eyes were sweet with affection, an affection very cold and very real. Then Keating felt as if the walls of the room were moving gently in upon him, pushing him into a terrible intimacy, not with Tui, but with some unknown guilt. He wanted to leap to his feet and run. He sat still, his mouth half open. And without knowing what prompted him, Keating heard his own voice in the silence. "And I did want to say how glad I was that you escaped that maniac's bullet yesterday, Mr. Tui."
"Oh? Oh, thanks. That, well, don't let it upset you. Just one of the minor penalties one pays for prominence in public life."
"I've never liked Mallory. A strange sort of person, too tense. I don't like people who are tense. I've never liked his work, either."
"Just an exhibitionist. Won't amount to much.
It wasn't my idea, of course, to give him a try. It was Mr. Slotnick's. Pull, you know. But Mr. Slotnick knew better in the end."
"Did Mallory ever mention my name to you?"
"No, never."
"I haven't even met him, you know. Never saw him before. Why did he do it?"
And then it was Tui who sat still, before what he saw in Keating's face. Tui, alert and insecure for the first time. This was it, thought Keating. This was the bond between them. And the bond was fear.
and more, much more than that, but fear was the only recognizable name to give it. And he knew with unreasoning finality that he liked Toohey better than any man he had ever met. "Well, you know how it is," said Keating brightly, hoping that the commonplace he was about to utter would close the subject. "Mallory is an incompetent and knows it, and he decided to take it out on you as on a symbol of the great and the able." But instead of a smile, Keating saw the shot of Toohey's sudden glance at him. It was not a glance, it was a fluoroscope. He thought he could feel it crawling, searchingly inside his bones. Then Toohey's face seemed to harden, drawing together again in composure, and Keating knew that Toohey had found relief somewhere, in his bones or in his gaping, bewildered face, that some hidden immensity of ignorance within him had given Toohey reassurance. Then Toohey said slowly, strangely, derisively, "You and I, we're going to be great friends, Peter." Keating let a moment pass before he caught himself to answer hastily, "Oh, I hope so, Mr. Toohey." "Really, Peter, I'm not as old as all that, am I? Ellsworth is the monument to my parents' peculiar taste in nomenclature." "Yes, Ellsworth." "That's better. I really don't mind the name when compared to some of the things I've been called privately and publicly these many years." "Oh, well, flattering. When one makes enemies, one knows that one's dangerous where it's necessary to be dangerous. There are things that must be destroyed, or they'll destroy us. We'll see a great deal of each other, Peter." The voice was smooth and sure now, with the finality of a decision tested and reached, with the certainty that never again would anything in Keating be a question mark to him. "For instance, I've been thinking for some time of getting together a few young architects, I know so many of them, just an informal little organization to exchange ideas, you know, to develop a spirit of cooperation, to follow a common line of action for the common good of the profession, if necessity arises. Nothing as stuffy as the AGA, just a youth group. Think you'd be interested?" "Why, of course. And you'd be the chairman?" "Oh, dear, no, I'm never chairman of anything, Peter. I dislike titles. No, I rather thought you'd make the right chairman for us. Can't think of anyone better."
"Me?"
"You, Peter." "Oh, well, it's only a project. Nothing definite, just an idea I've been toying with in odd moments. We'll talk about it some other time. There's something I'd like you to do, and that's really one of the reasons why I wanted to meet you."
"Oh, sure, Mr. Too. Sure, Ellsworth. Anything I can do for you."
"It's not for me. Do you know Lois Cook?"
"Lois? Who?"
"Cook. You don't, but you will. That young woman is the greatest literary genius since Goethe. You must read her, Peter. I don't suggest that as a rule, except to the discriminating. She's so much above the heads of the middle class who love the obvious. She's planning to build a house, a little private residence on the Bowery. Yes, on the Bowery, just like Lois. She's asked me to recommend an architect. I'm certain that it will take a person like you to understand a person like Lois. I'm going to give her your name, if you're interested in what is to be a small, though quite costly, residence."
"But of course, that's very kind of you, Ellsworth. You know, I thought when you said, and when I read your note, that you wanted, well, some favor from me, you know, a good turn for a good turn. And here you're..."
"My dear Peter, how naive you are."
"Oh, I suppose I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you.
I don't mind. You must learn to know me better. Strange as it may sound, a totally selfless interest in one's fellow men is possible in this world, Peter."
Then they talked about Lois Cook and her three published works.
"Novels. No, Peter, not exactly novels. No, not collections of stories, either. That's just it. Just Lois Cook, a new form of literature entirely."
About the fortune she had inherited from a long line of successful tradesmen, and about the house she planned to build. It was only when Toohey had risen to escort Keating to the door, and Keating noticed how precariously erect he stood on his very small feet, that Toohey paused suddenly to say, "Incidentally, it seems to me as if I should remember some personal connection between us, though for the life of me I can't quite place..."
"Oh yes, of course. My niece... little Catherine."
Keating felt his face tighten, and knew he must not allow this to be discussed, but smiled awkwardly instead of protesting.
I understand you're engaged to her.
Yes.
Charming, said Tui. Very charming. Should enjoy being your uncle. You love her very much?
Yes, said Keating. Very much.
The absence of stress in his voice made the answer solemn. It was, laid before Tui, the first bit of sincerity and of importance within Keating's being.
How pretty, said Tui.
Young love, spring and dawn in heaven, and drugstore chocolates at $1.25 a box. The prerogative of the gods and of the movies. Oh, I do approve, Peter. I think it's lovely. You couldn't have made a better choice than Catherine. She's just the kind for whom the world is well lost. The world, with all its problems and all its opportunities for greatness. Oh, yes, well lost, because she's innocent and sweet and pretty and anemic.
If you're going to... Keating began. But Tui smiled with a luminous sort of kindliness.
Oh, Peter, of course I understand, and I approve. I'm a realist. Man has always insisted on making an ass of himself. Oh, come now, we must never lose our sense of humor. Nothing's really sacred but a sense of humor. Still, I've always loved the tale of Tristan and Isolde. It's the most beautiful story ever told, next to that of Mickey and Minnie Mouse.
Chapter 4 Toothbrush in the jaw, toothbrush, brush, brush, tooth jaw, foam dome in the foam, Roman dome, come home, home in the jaw, Rome dome, tooth, toothbrush, toothpick, pickpocket, socket rocket. Peter Keating squinted his eyes, his glance unfocused as for a great distance, but put the book down. The book was thin and black, with scarlet letters forming Clouds and Shrouds by Lois Cook. The jacket said that it was a record of Miss Cook's travels around the world. Keating leaned back with a sense of warmth and well-being. He liked this book. It had made the routine of his Sunday morning breakfast a profound spiritual experience. He was certain that it was profound, because he didn't understand it. Peter Keating had never felt the need to formulate abstract convictions, but he had a working substitute. A thing is not high if one can reach it. It is not great if one can reason about it. It is not deep if one can see its bottom. This had always been his credo, unstated and unquestioned. This spared him any attempt to reach, reason, or see, and it cast a nice reflection of scorn on those who made the attempt. So he was able to enjoy the work of Lois Cook. He felt uplifted by the knowledge of his own capacity to respond to the abstract, the profound, the ideal. Tui had said,
That's just it. Sound as sound. The poetry of words as words. Style as a revolt against style. But only the finest spirit can appreciate it, Peter.
Keating thought he could talk of this book to his friends, and if they did not understand, he would know that he was superior to them. He would not need to explain that superiority. That's just it. Superiority as superiority. Automatically denied to those who asked for explanations. He loved the book. He reached for another piece of toast. He saw at the end of the table, left there for him by his mother, the heavy pile of the Sunday paper. He picked it up, feeling strong enough in this moment, in the confidence of his secret spiritual grandeur, to face the whole world contained in that pile. He pulled out the rotogravure section. He stopped. He saw the reproduction of a drawing. The Enright House by Howard Rourke. He did not need to see the caption or the brusque signature in the corner of the sketch. He knew that no one else had conceived that house, and he knew the manner of drawing, serene and violent at once. The pencil lines, like high-tension wires on the paper, slender and innocent to see, but not to be touched. It was a structure on a broad space by the East River. He did not grasp it as a building, at first glance, but as a rising mass of rock crystal. There was the same severe mathematical order holding together a free, fantastic growth. Straight lines and clean angles, space slashed with a knife, yet in a harmony of formation as delicate as the work of a jeweler, an incredible variety of shapes, each separate unit unrepeated, but leading inevitably to the next one and to the whole, so that the future inhabitants were to have not a square cage out of a square pile of cages, but each a single house, held to the other houses like a single crystal to the side of a rock. Keating looked at the sketch. He had known for a long time that Howard Rourke had been chosen to build the Enright House,
He had seen a few mentions of Rourke's name in the papers. Not much, all of it to be summed up only as some young architect chosen by Mr. Enright for some reason, probably an interesting young architect. The caption under the drawing announced that the construction of the project was to begin at once. Well, thought Keating, and dropped the paper. So what? The paper fell beside the black and scarlet book. He looked at both. He felt dimly as if Lois Cook were his defense against Howard Rourke.
"What's that, Petey?"
his mother's voice asked behind him. He handed the paper to her over his shoulder. The paper fell past him back to the table in a second.
"Oh,"
shrugged Mrs. Keating.
"Huh."
She stood beside him. Her trim silk dress was fitted too tightly, revealing the solid rigidity of her corset. A small pin glittered at her throat, small enough to display ostentatiously that it was made of real diamonds. She was like the new apartment into which they had moved, conspicuously expensive. The apartment's decoration had been Keating's first professional job for himself. It had been furnished in fresh, new mid-Victorian. It was conservative and stately. Over the fireplace in the drawing room hung a large old painting of what was not but looked like an illustrious ancestor.
"Petey, sweetheart, I do hate to rush you on a Sunday morning, but isn't it time to dress up? I've got to run now, and I'd hate you to forget the time and be late. It's so nice of Mr. Toohey asking you to his house."
"Yes, mother."
"Any famous guests coming, too?"
"No, no guests. But there will be one other person there, not famous." She looked at him expectantly. He added, "Katie will be there." The name seemed to have no effect on her whatever. A strange assurance had coated her lately, like a layer of fat through which that particular question could penetrate no longer. "Just a family tea," he emphasized. "That's what he said."
"Very nice of him. I'm sure Mr. Toohey is a very intelligent man."
"Yes, mother." He rose impatiently and went to his room. It was Keating's first visit to the distinguished residential hotel where Catherine and her uncle had moved recently. He did not notice much about the apartment, beyond remembering that it was simple, very clean, and smartly modest, that it contained a great number of books and very few pictures, but these authentic and precious. One never remembered the apartment of Ellsworth Toohey, only its host. The host on this Sunday afternoon wore a dark gray suit, correct as a uniform, and bedroom slippers of black patent leather trimmed with red. The slippers mocked the severe elegance of the suit, yet completed the elegance as an audacious anticlimax. He sat in a broad, low chair, and his face wore an expression of cautious gentleness, so cautious that Keating and Catherine felt at times as if they were insignificant soap bubbles. Keating did not like the way Catherine sat on the edge of a chair, hunched, her legs drawn awkwardly together. He wished she would not wear the same suit for the third season, but she did. She kept her eyes on one point somewhere in the middle of the carpet. She seldom looked at Keating. She never looked at her uncle. Keating found no trace of that joyous admiration with which she had always spoken of Toohey, which he had expected to see her display in his presence. There was something heavy and colorless about Catherine, and very tired. Toohey's valet brought in the tea tray.
"You will pour, won't you please, my dear?" said Toohey to Catherine. "Ah, there's nothing like tea in the afternoon. When the British Empire collapses, historians will find that it had made but two invaluable contributions to civilization, this tea ritual and the detective novel. Catherine, my dear, do you have to grasp that pot handle as if it were a meat axe? But never mind, it's charming. It's really what we love you for, Peter and I. We wouldn't love you if you were graceful as a duchess. Who wants a duchess nowadays?"
Catherine poured the tea and spilled it on the glass tabletop, which she had never done before.
"I did want to see you two together for once," said Toohey, holding a delicate cup, balanced, nonchalantly. "Perfectly silly of me, isn't it? There's really nothing to make an occasion of, but then I'm silly and sentimental at times, like all of us. My compliments on your choice, Catherine. I owe you an apology. I never suspected you of such good taste. You and Peter make a wonderful couple. You'll do a great deal for him. You'll cook his cream of wheat, launder his handkerchiefs, and bear his children. Though, of course, the children will all have measles at one time or another, which is a nuisance."
"But after all, you do approve of it?" Keating asked anxiously.
"Approve of it? Of what, Peter?" of our marriage, eventually.
What a superfluous question, Peter. Of course I approve of it, but how young you are. That's the way of young people. They make an issue where none exists. You asked that as if the whole thing were important enough to disapprove of.
Katie and I met 7 years ago, said Keating, defensively.
And it was love at first sight, of course.
Yes, said Keating, and felt himself being ridiculous.
It must have been spring, said Tui.
It usually is. There's always a dark movie theater and two people lost to the world, their hands clasped together, but hands do perspire when held too long, don't they? Still, it's beautiful to be in love. The sweetest story ever told, and the tritest. Don't turn away like that, Catherine. We must never allow ourselves to lose our sense of humor.
He smiled. The kindliness of his smile embraced them both. The kindliness was so great that it made their love seem small and mean, because only something contemptible could evoke such immensity of compassion. He asked,
Incidentally, Peter, when do you intend to get married?
Oh, well, we've never really set a definite date. You know how it's been. All the things happening to me, and now Katie has this work of hers, and...
And by the way, he added sharply, because that matter of Katie's work irritated him without reason. When we're married, Katie will have to give that up. I don't approve of it.
But of course, said Tui, I don't approve of it either, if Catherine doesn't like it.
Catherine was working as day nursery attendant at the Clifford Settlement House. It had been her own idea. She had visited the settlement often with her uncle, who conducted classes in economics there, and she had become interested in the work.
But I do like it, she said with sudden excitement. I don't see why you resent it, Peter.
There was a harsh little note in her voice, defiant and unpleasant.
I've never enjoyed anything so much in my life, helping people who are helpless and unhappy. I went there this morning. I didn't have to, but I wanted to. And then I rushed so on my way home I didn't have time to change my clothes. But that doesn't matter. Who cares what I look like? And
the harsh note was gone. She was speaking eagerly and very fast. Uncle Ellsworth, imagine, little Billy Hansen had a sore throat. You remember Billy? And the nurse wasn't there. And I had to swab his throat with Argyrol, the poor thing. And he had the most awful white mucus patches down in his throat.
Her voice seemed to shine, as if she were speaking of great beauty.
She looked at her uncle. For the first time Keating saw the affection he had expected. She went on speaking about her work, the children, the settlement. Tui listened gravely. He said nothing. But the earnest attention in his eyes changed him. His mocking gaiety vanished, and he forgot his own advice. He was being serious. Very serious indeed. When he noticed that Catherine's plate was empty, he offered her the sandwich tray with a simple gesture, and made it, somehow, a gracious gesture of respect. Keating waited impatiently till she paused for an instant. He wanted to change the subject. He glanced about the room and saw the Sunday papers. This was a question he had wanted to ask for a long time. He asked cautiously,
Ellsworth, what do you think of Rourke?
Rourke? Rourke? Asked Tui. Who is Rourke?
The too innocent, too trifling manner in which he repeated the name, with the faint contemptuous question mark quite audible at the end, made Keating certain that Tui knew the name well. One did not stress total ignorance of a subject if one were in total ignorance of it. Keating said,
Howard Rourke. You know, the architect. The one who's doing the Enright House.
Oh? Oh, yes, someone's doing that Enright House at last, isn't he?
There's a picture of it in the Chronicle today.
Is there? I did glance through the Chronicle.
And what do you think of that building?
If it were important, I should have remembered it.
Of course.
Keating's syllables danced, as if his breath caught at each one in passing.
It's an awful crazy thing, like nothing you ever saw or want to see.
He felt a sense of deliverance. It was as if he had spent his life believing that he carried a congenital disease, and suddenly the words of the greatest specialist on earth had pronounced him healthy. He wanted to laugh, freely, stupidly, without dignity. He wanted to talk.
Howard's a friend of mine, he said happily.
A friend of yours? You know him?
Do I know him? Why, we went to school together. Stanton, you know. Why, he lived at our house for 3 years. I can tell you the color of his underwear and how he takes a shower. I've seen him.
He lived at your house in Stanton? Toohey repeated.
Toohey spoke with a kind of cautious precision. The sounds of his voice were small and dry and final, like the cracks of matches being broken. It was very peculiar, thought Keating. Toohey was asking him a great many questions about Howard Rourke. But the questions did not make sense. They were not about buildings. They were not about architecture at all. They were pointless, personal questions. Strange to ask about a man of whom he had never heard before.
Does he laugh often?
Very rarely. Does he seem unhappy?
Never. Did he have many friends at Stanton?
He's never had any friends anywhere.
The boys didn't like him.
Nobody can like him.
Why?
He makes you feel it would be an impertinence to like him.
Did he go out, drink, have a good time?
Never.
Does he like money?
No.
Does he like to be admired?
No.
Does he believe in God?
No.
Does he talk much?
Very little.
Does he listen if others discuss any idea with him?
He listens. It would be better if he didn't.
Why?
It would be less insulting. If you know what I mean, when a man listens like that and you know it hasn't made the slightest bit of difference to him.
Did he always want to be an architect?
He...
What's the matter, Peter?
Nothing. It just occurred to me how strange it is that I've never asked myself that about him before. Here's what's strange. You can't ask that about him. He's a maniac on the subject of architecture. It seems to mean so damn much to him that he's lost all human perspective. He just has no sense of humor about himself at all. Now there's a man without a sense of humor, Ellsworth. You don't ask what he'd do if he didn't want to be an architect.
No,
said Toohey.
You ask what he'd do if he couldn't be an architect.
He'd walk over corpses, any and all of them, all of us. But he'd be an architect. Toohey folded his napkin, a crisp little square of cloth on his knee. He folded it accurately, once across each way, and he ran his fingernail along the edges to make a sharp crease.
"Do you remember our little youth group of architects, Peter?"
he asked.
"I'm making arrangements for a first meeting soon. I've spoken to many of our future members, and you'd be flattered by what they said about you as our prospective chairman."
They talked pleasantly for another half hour. When Keating rose to go, Toohey declared,
"Oh, yes, I did speak to Lois Cook about you. You'll hear from her shortly."
"Thank you so much, Ellsworth. By the way, I'm reading Clouds and Shrouds."
"And?"
"Oh, it's tremendous. You know, Ellsworth, it makes you think so differently about everything you've thought before."
"Yes," said Toohey. "Doesn't it?"
He stood at the window, looking out at the last sunshine of a cold, bright afternoon. Then he turned and said,
"It's a lovely day, probably one of the last this year. Why don't you take Catherine out for a little walk, Peter?"
"Oh, I'd love to," said Catherine eagerly.
"Well, go ahead,"
Toohey smiled gaily.
"What's the matter, Catherine? Do you have to wait for my permission?"
When they walked out together, when they were alone in the cold brilliance of streets flooded with late sunlight, Keating felt himself recapturing everything Catherine had always meant to him, the strange emotion that he could not keep in the presence of others. He closed his hand over hers. She withdrew her hand, took off her glove, and slipped her fingers into his. And then he thought suddenly that hands did perspire when held too long, and he walked faster in irritation. He thought that they were walking there like Mickey and Minnie Mouse, and that they probably appeared ridiculous to the passers-by. To shake himself free of these thoughts, he glanced down at her face. She was looking straight ahead at the gold light. He saw her delicate profile, and the faint crease of a smile in the corner of her mouth, a smile of quiet happiness. But he noticed that the edge of her eyelid was pale, and he began to wonder whether she was anemic. Lois Cook sat on the floor in the middle of her living room, her legs crossed, Turkish fashion, showing large bare knees, gray stockings rolled over tight garters, and a piece of faded pink drawers. Peter Keating sat on the edge of a violet satin chaise longue. Never before had he felt uncomfortable at a first interview with a client. Lois Cook was 37. She had stated insistently in her publicity and in private conversation that she was 64. It was repeated as a whimsical joke,
and it created about her name a vague impression of eternal youth. She was tall, dry, narrow-shouldered, and broad-hipped. She had a long, sallow face and eyes set close together. Her hair hung about her ears in greasy strands. Her fingernails were broken. She looked offensively unkempt, with studied slovenliness as careful as grooming, and for the same purpose. She talked incessantly, rocking back and forth on her haunches.
"Yes, on the Bowery, a private residence, the shrine on the Bowery. I have the site, I wanted it, and I bought it, as simple as that, or my fool lawyer bought it for me. You must meet my lawyer. He has halitosis. I don't know what you'll cost me, but it's unessential. Money is commonplace. Cabbage is commonplace, too. It must have 3 stories and a living room with a tile floor."
"Miss Cook, I've read Clouds and Shrouds, and it was a spiritual revelation to me. Allow me to include myself among the few who understand the courage and significance of what you're achieving single-handed while—"
"Oh, can the crap," said Lois Cook, and winked at him.
"But I mean it," he snapped angrily.
"I loved your book. I—"
She looked bored.
"It is so commonplace," she drawled, "to be understood by everybody."
"But Mr. Toohey said—"
"Ah, yes, Mr. Toohey."
Her eyes were alert now, insolently guilty, like the eyes of a child who has just perpetrated some nasty little joke.
"Mr. Toohey, I'm chairman of a little youth group of writers in which Mr. Toohey is very interested."
"You are," he said happily. It seemed to be the first direct communication between them. "Isn't that interesting? Mr. Toohey is getting together a little youth group of architects, too, and he's kind enough to have me in mind for chairman."
"Oh,"
she said, and winked.
"One of us?"
"Of whom?" He did not know what he had done, but he knew that he had disappointed her in some way. She began to laugh. She sat there looking up at him, laughing deliberately in his face, laughing ungraciously, and not gaily.
"What the—"
He controlled himself.
"What's the matter, Miss Cook?" "Oh, my," she said. "You're such a sweet, sweet boy, and so pretty."
"Mr. Toohey is a great man," he said angrily. "He's the most, the noblest personality I've ever—"
"Oh, yes, Mr. Toohey is a wonderful man."
Her voice was strange by omission. It was flagrantly devoid of respect.
"My best friend, the most wonderful man on earth. There's the earth and there's Mr. Toohey, a law of nature. Besides, think how nicely you can rhyme it. Toohey, gooey, fooey, hooey. Nevertheless, he's a saint. That's very rare. As rare as genius. I'm a genius. I want a living room without windows. No windows at all. Remember that when you draw up the plans. No windows. A tile floor and a black ceiling. And no electricity. I want no electricity in my house. Just kerosene lamps. Kerosene lamps with chimneys and candles. To hell with Thomas Edison. Who was he, anyway?"
Her words did not disturb him as much as her smile. It was not a smile. It was a permanent smirk, raising the corners of her long mouth, making her look like a sly, vicious imp.
"And, Keating, I want the house to be ugly, magnificently ugly. I want it to be the ugliest house in New York."
"The ugliest, Miss Cook?"
"Sweetheart, the beautiful is so commonplace."
"Yes, but I'm—" "Well, I don't see how I could permit myself to—"
"Keating, where's your courage? Aren't you capable of a sublime gesture on occasion? They all work so hard and struggle and suffer, trying to achieve beauty, trying to surpass one another in beauty. Let's surpass them all. Let's throw their sweat in their face. Let's destroy them at one stroke. Let's be gods. Let's be ugly."
He accepted the commission. After a few weeks, he stopped feeling uneasy about it. Wherever he mentioned this new job, he met a respectful curiosity. It was an amused curiosity, but it was respectful. The name of Lois Cook was well known in the best drawing rooms he visited. The titles of her books were flashed in conversation like the diamonds in the speaker's intellectual crown. There was always a note of challenge in the voices pronouncing them. It sounded as if the speaker were being very brave. It was a satisfying bravery. It never aroused antagonism. For an author who did not sell, her name seemed strangely famous and honored. She was the standard-bearer of a vanguard of intellect and revolt. Only it was not quite clear to him just exactly what the revolt was against. Somehow he preferred not to know. He designed the house as she wished it. It was a 3-floor edifice, part marble, part stucco, adorned with gargoyles and carriage lanterns. It looked like a structure from an amusement park. His sketch of it was reproduced in more publications than any other drawing he had ever made, with the exception of the Kosmoslotnik building. One commentator expressed the opinion that Peter Keating is showing a promise of being more than just a bright young man with a knack for pleasing stuffy moguls of big business. He is venturing into the field of intellectual experimentation with a client such as Lois Cook. Toohey referred to the house as a cosmic joke. But a peculiar sensation remained in Keating's mind, the feeling of an aftertaste. He would experience a dim flash of it while working on some important structure he liked. He would experience it in the moments when he felt proud of his work. He could not identify the quality of the feeling, but he knew that part of it was a sense of shame. Once he confessed it to Ellsworth Toohey. Toohey laughed.
"That's good for you, Peter. One must never allow oneself to acquire an exaggerated sense of one's own importance. There's no necessity to burden oneself with absolutes."
Chapter 5. Dominique had returned to New York. She returned without purpose, merely because she could not stay in her country house longer than 3 days after her last visit to the quarry. She had to be in the city. It was a sudden necessity, irresistible and senseless. She expected nothing of the city, but she wanted the feeling of the streets and the buildings holding her there. In the morning when she awakened and heard the muffled roar of traffic far below, the sound was a humiliation, a reminder of where she was and why. She stood at the window, her arms spread wide, holding on to each side of the frame. It was as if she held a piece of the city, all the streets and rooftops outlined on the glass between her two hands. She went out alone for long walks. She walked fast, her hands in the pockets of an old coat, its collar raised. She had told herself that she was not hoping to meet him. She was not looking for him. But she had to be out in the streets, blank, purposeless, for hours at a time. She had always hated the streets of a city. She saw the faces streaming past her, the faces made alike by fear. Fear is a common denominator, fear of themselves, fear of all and of one another, fear making them ready to pounce upon whatever was held sacred by any single one they met. She could not define the nature or the reason of that fear, but she had always felt its presence. She had kept herself clean and free in a single passion, to touch nothing. She had liked facing them in the streets. She had liked the impotence of their hatred, because she offered them nothing to be hurt. She was not free any longer. Each step through the streets hurt her now. She was tied to him, and he was tied to every part of the city. He was a nameless worker doing some nameless job, lost in these crowds, dependent on them, to be hurt by any one of them, to be shared by her with the whole city. She hated the thought of him on the sidewalks people had used. She hated the thought of a clerk handing to him a package of cigarettes across a counter. She hated the elbows touching his elbows in a subway train. She came home after these walks, shaking with fever. She went out again the next day. When the term of her vacation expired, she went to the office of the Banner in order to resign. Her work and her column did not seem amusing to her any longer. She stopped Alva Skerritt's effusive greetings. She said, "I just came back to tell you that I'm quitting, Alva." He looked at her stupidly. He uttered only, "Why?" It was the first sound from the outside world to reach her in a long time. She had always acted on the impulse of the moment, proud of the freedom to need no reasons for her actions. Now she had to face a why that carried an answer she could not escape. She thought, because of him. Because she was letting him change the course of her life. It would be another violation. She could see him smiling as he had smiled on the path in the woods. She had no choice. Either course taken would be taken under compulsion. She could leave her work because he had made her want to leave it, or she could remain hating it in order to keep her life unchanged in defiance of him. The last was harder. She raised her head. She said, "Just a joke, Alva. Just wanted to see what you'd say. I'm not quitting." She had been back at work for a few days when Ellsworth Toohey walked into her office.
"Hello, Dominique," he said.
Just heard you're back.
Hello, Ellsworth.
I'm glad. You know, I've always had the feeling that you'll walk out on us some morning without any reason.
The feeling, Ellsworth? Or the hope?
He was looking at her, his eyes as kindly, his smile as charming as ever. But there was a tinge of self-mockery in the charm, as if he knew that she did not approve of it, and a tinge of assurance, as if he were showing that he would look kindly and charming just the same.
You know you're wrong there, he said, smiling peacefully. You've always been wrong about that.
No. I don't fit, Ellsworth, do I?
I could, of course, ask, into what? But supposing I don't ask it. Supposing I just say that people who don't fit have their uses also, as well as those who do. Would you like that better? Of course, the simple thing to say is that I've always been a great admirer of yours, and always will be.
That's not a compliment.
Somehow, I don't think we'll ever be enemies, Dominique, if that's what you like.
No, I don't think we'll ever be enemies, Ellsworth. You're the most comforting person I know.
Of course.
In the sense I mean?
In any sense you wish.
On the desk before her lay the rotogravure section of the Sunday Chronicle. It was folded on the page that bore the drawing of the Enright house. She picked it up and held it out to him, her eyes narrowed in a silent question. He looked at the drawing. Then his glance moved to her face and returned to the drawing. He let the paper drop back on the desk.
As independent as an insult, isn't it? He said.
You know, Ellsworth, I think the man who designed this should have committed suicide. A man who can conceive a thing as beautiful as this should never allow it to be erected. He should not want it to exist. But he will let it be built so that women will hang diapers on his terraces, so that men will spit on his stairways and draw dirty pictures on his walls. He's given it to them, and he's made it part of them, part of everything. He shouldn't have offered it for men like you to look at, for men like you to talk about. He's defiled his own work by the first word you'll utter about it. He's made himself worse than you are. You'll be committing only a mean little indecency, but he's committed a sacrilege. A man who knows what he must have known to produce this should not have been able to remain alive.
Going to write a piece about this? He asked.
No, that would be repeating his crime.
And talking to me about it?
She looked at him. He was smiling pleasantly.
Yes, of course, she said. That's part of the same crime also.
Let's have dinner together one of these days, Dominique, he said. You really don't let me see enough of you.
All right, she said. Any time you wish.
At his trial for the assault on Ellsworth Toohey, Stephen Mallory refused to disclose his motive. He made no statement. He seemed indifferent to any possible sentence. But Ellsworth Toohey created a minor sensation when he appeared unsolicited in Mallory's defense. He pleaded with the judge for leniency. He explained that he had no desire to see Mallory's future and career destroyed. Everybody in the courtroom was touched, except Stephen Mallory. Stephen Mallory listened and looked as if he were enduring some special process of cruelty. The judge gave him 2 years and suspended the sentence. There was a great deal of comment on Toohey's extraordinary generosity. Toohey dismissed all praise, gaily and modestly.
My friends, was his remark, the one to appear in all the papers. I refuse to be an accomplice in the manufacturing of martyrs.
At the first meeting of the proposed organization of young architects, Keating concluded that Toohey had a wonderful ability for choosing people who fitted well together. There was an air about the 18 persons present which he could not define, but which gave him a sense of comfort, a security he had not experienced in solitude or in any other gathering. And part of the comfort was the knowledge that all the others felt the same way, for the same unaccountable reason. It was a feeling of brotherhood, but somehow not of a sainted or noble brotherhood. Yet this precisely was the comfort, that one felt among them no necessity for being sainted or noble. Were it not for this kinship, Keating would have been disappointed in the gathering. Of the 18 seated about Toohey's living room, none was an architect of distinction, except himself and Gordon L. Prescott, who wore a beige turtleneck sweater and looked faintly patronizing, but eager. Keating had never heard the names of the others. Most of them were beginners, young, poorly dressed, and belligerent. Some were only draftsmen. There was one woman architect who had built a few small private homes, mainly for wealthy widows. She had an aggressive manner, a tight mouth, and a fresh petunia in her hair. There was a boy with pure, innocent eyes. There was an obscure contractor with a fat, expressionless face. There was a tall, dry woman who was an interior decorator. And another woman of no definite occupation at all. Keating could not understand what exactly was to be the purpose of the group, though there was a great deal of talk. None of the talk was too coherent, but all of it seemed to have the same undercurrent. He felt that the undercurrent was the one thing clear among all the vague generalities, even though nobody would mention it. It held him there, as it held the others, and he had no desire to define it. The young men talked a great deal about injustice, unfairness, the cruelty of society toward youth, and suggested that everyone should have his future commissions guaranteed when he left college. The woman architect shrieked briefly something about the iniquity of the rich. The contractor barked that it was a hard world, and that fellows got to help one another. The boy with the innocent eyes pleaded that we could do so much good. His voice had a note of desperate sincerity which seemed embarrassing and out of place. Gordon L. Prescott declared that the AGA was a bunch of old fogies with no conception of social responsibility and not a drop of virile blood in the lot of them, and that it was time to kick them in the pants anyway. The woman of indefinite occupation spoke about ideals and causes, though nobody could gather just what these were. Peter Keating was elected chairman unanimously. Gordon L. Prescott was elected vice chairman and treasurer. Toohey declined all nominations. He declared that he would act only as an unofficial advisor. It was decided that the organization would be named the Council of American Builders. It was decided that membership would not be restricted to architects, but would be open to allied crafts and to all those holding the interests of the great profession of building at heart. Then Toohey spoke. He spoke at some length, standing up, leaning on the knuckles of one hand against a table. His great voice was soft and persuasive. It filled the room, but it made his listeners realize that it could have filled a Roman amphitheater. There was something subtly flattering in this realization, in the sound of the powerful voice being held in check for their benefit. "And thus, my friends, what the architectural profession lacks is an understanding of its own social importance. This lack is due to a double cause, to the antisocial nature of our entire society, and to your own inherent modesty. You have been conditioned to think of yourselves merely as breadwinners with no higher purpose than to earn your fees and the means of your own existence. Isn't it time, my friends, to pause and to redefine your position in society? Of all the crafts, yours is the most important. Important not in the amount of money you might make, not in the degree of artistic skill you might exhibit, but in the service you render to your fellow men. You are those who provide mankind's shelter. Remember this, and then look at our cities, at our slums, to realize the gigantic task awaiting you. But to meet this challenge, you must be armed with a broader vision of yourselves and of your work. You are not hired lackeys of the rich. You are crusaders in the cause of the underprivileged and the unsheltered. Not by what we are shall we be judged, but by those we serve. Let us stand united in this spirit. Let us in all matters be faithful to this new, broader, higher perspective. Let us organize, well, my friends, shall I say, a nobler dream? Keating listened avidly. He had always thought of himself as a breadwinner, bent upon earning his fees, in a profession he had chosen because his mother had wanted him to choose it. It was gratifying to discover that he was much more than this, that his daily activity carried a nobler significance. It was pleasant, and it was drugging. He knew that all the others in the room felt it also. "And when our system of society collapses, the craft of builders will not be swept under. It will be swept up to greater prominence and greater recognition." The doorbell rang. Then Toohey's valet appeared for an instant, holding the door of the living room open to admit Dominique Francone. By the manner in which Toohey stopped on a half-uttered word, Keating knew that Dominique had not been invited or expected. She smiled at Toohey, shook her head, and moved one hand in a gesture telling him to continue. He managed a faint bow in her direction, barely more than a movement of his eyebrows, and went on with his speech. It was a pleasant greeting, and its informality included the guest in the intimate brotherhood of the occasion. but it seemed to Keating that it had come just one beat too late. He had never before seen Tui miss the right moment. Dominique sat down in a corner behind the others. Keating forgot to listen for a while, trying to attract her attention. He had to wait until her eyes had traveled thoughtfully about the room from face to face, and stopped on his. He bowed and nodded vigorously, with the smile of greeting a private possession. She inclined her head. He saw her lashes touching her cheeks for an instant, as her eyes closed. And then she looked at him again. She sat looking at him for a long moment, without smiling, as if she were rediscovering something in his face. He had not seen her since spring. He thought that she looked a little tired, and lovelier than his memory of her. Then he turned to Ellsworth Tui once more, and he listened. The words he heard were as stirring as ever, but his pleasure in them had an edge of uneasiness. He looked at Dominique. She did not belong in this room, at this meeting. He could not say why, but the certainty of it was enormous and oppressive. It was not her beauty. It was not her insolent elegance. But something made her an outsider. It was as if they had all been comfortably naked, and a person had entered fully clothed, suddenly making them self-conscious and indecent. Yet she did nothing. She sat listening attentively. Once she leaned back, crossing her legs, and lighted a cigarette. She shook the flame off the match with a brusque little jerk of her wrist, and she dropped the match into an ashtray on a table beside her. He saw her drop the match into the ashtray. He felt as if that movement of her wrist had tossed the match into all their faces. He thought that he was being preposterous, but he noticed that Ellsworth Tui never looked at her as he spoke. When the meeting ended, Tui rushed over to her.
"Dominique, my dear," he said brightly. "Shall I consider myself flattered?
If you wish.
Had I known that you were interested, I would have sent you a very special invitation."
"But you didn't think I'd be interested?"
"No, frankly.
That was a mistake, Ellsworth. You discounted my newspaper woman's instinct. Never miss a scoop. It's not often that one has the chance to witness the birth of a felony."
"Just exactly what do you mean, Dominique?" asked Keating, his voice sharp.
She turned to him. "Hello, Peter."
"You know Peter Keating, of course."
Tui smiled at her. "Oh, yes, Peter was in love with me once."
"You're using the wrong tense, Dominique," said Keating. "You must never take seriously anything Dominique chooses to say, Peter. She does not intend us to take it seriously. Would you like to join our little group, Dominique? Your professional qualifications make you eminently eligible."
"No, Ellsworth. I wouldn't like to join your little group. I really don't hate you enough to do that."
"Just why do you disapprove of it?" snapped Keating.
"Why, Peter," she drawled. "Whatever gave you that idea?" "I don't disapprove of it at all. Do I, Ellsworth? I think it's a proper undertaking in answer to an obvious necessity. It's just what we all need and deserve."
"Can we count on your presence at our next meeting?" Tui asked. "It is pleasant to have so understanding a listener who will not be in the way at all. At our next meeting, I mean."
"No, Ellsworth, thank you. It was merely curiosity. Though you do have an interesting group of people here. Young builders. By the way, why didn't you invite that man who designed the Enright House? What's his name?" "Howard Rourke."
Keating felt his jaw snap tight.
But she looked at them innocently. She had said it lightly, in the tone of a casual remark. Surely, he thought, she did not mean...
"What?" he asked himself. And added, she did not mean whatever it was he'd thought for a moment she meant. Whatever had terrified him in that moment. "I have never had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Rourke,"
Tui answered gravely.
"Do you know him?" Keating asked her.
"No," she answered. "I've merely seen a sketch of the Enright House."
"And?" Keating insisted. "What do you think of it?"
"I don't think of it," she answered.
When she turned to leave, Keating accompanied her. He looked at her in the elevator on their way down. He saw her hand, in a tight black glove, holding the flat corner of a pocketbook. The limp carelessness of her fingers was insolent and inviting at once. He felt himself surrendering to her again.
"Dominique, why did you actually come here today?" "Oh, I haven't been anywhere for a long time, and I decided to start in with that. You know, when I go swimming, I don't like to torture myself getting into cold water by degrees. I dive right in, and it's a nasty shock. But after that, the rest is not so hard to take."
"What do you mean?"
What do you really see that's so wrong with that meeting? After all, we're not planning to do anything definite. We don't have any actual program. I don't even know what we were there for.
That's it, Peter. You don't even know what you were there for.
It's only a group for fellows to get together, mostly to talk. What harm is there in that?
Peter, I'm tired.
Well, did your appearance tonight mean at least that you're coming out of your seclusion?
Yes, just that.
My seclusion? I've tried and tried to get in touch with you, you know.
Have you?
Shall I begin to tell you how happy I am to see you again?
No.
Let's consider that you've told me.
You know you've changed, Dominique.
I don't know exactly in what way, but you've changed.
Have I?
Let's consider that I've told you how lovely you are, because I can't find words to say it. The streets were dark. He called a cab. Sitting close to her, he turned and looked at her directly, his glance compelling like an open hint, hoping to make the silence significant between them. She did not turn away. She sat studying his face. She seemed to be wondering, attentive to some thought of her own which he could not guess. He reached over slowly and took her hand. He felt an effort in her hand. He could feel through her rigid fingers the effort of her whole arm, not an effort to withdraw her hand, but to let him hold it. He raised the hand, turned it over, and pressed his lips to her wrist. Then he looked at her face. He dropped her hand, and it remained suspended in the air for an instant, the fingers stiff, half-closed. This was not the indifference he remembered. This was revulsion, so great that it became impersonal. It could not offend him. It seemed to include more than his person. He was suddenly aware of her body, not in desire or resentment, but just aware of its presence close to him, under her dress. He whispered involuntarily, "Dominique, who was he?" She whirled to face him. Then he saw her eyes narrowing. He saw her lips relaxing, growing fuller, softer, her mouth lengthening slowly into a faint smile without opening. She answered, looking straight at him, "A workman in the granite quarry." She succeeded. He laughed aloud. "Serves me right, Dominique. I shouldn't suspect the impossible. Peter, isn't it strange? It was you that I thought I could make myself want at one time. Why is that strange? Only in thinking how little we know about ourselves. Some day you'll know the truth about yourself too, Peter, and it will be worse for you than for most of us. But you don't have to think about it. It won't come for a long time. You did want me, Dominique? I thought I could never want anything, and you suited that so well. I don't know what you mean. I don't know what you ever think you're saying. I know that I'll always love you, and I won't let you disappear again. Now that you're back, now that I'm back, Peter, I don't want to see you again. Oh, I'll have to see you when we run into each other, as we will, but don't call on me. Don't come to see me. I'm not trying to offend you, Peter. It's not that. You've done nothing to make me angry. It's something in myself that I don't want to face again. I'm sorry to choose you as the example. But you suit so well. You, Peter, you're everything I despise in the world, and I don't want to remember how much I despise it. If I let myself remember, I'll return to it. This is not an insult to you, Peter. Try to understand that. You're not the worst of the world. You're its best. That's what's frightening. If I ever come back to you, don't let me come. I'm saying this now because I can, but if I come back to you, you won't be able to stop me, and now is the only time when I can warn you. I don't know, he said in cold fury, his lip stiff, what you're talking about. Don't try to know. It doesn't matter. Let's just stay away from each other, shall we? I'll never give you up. She shrugged. All right, Peter. This is the only time I've ever been kind to you. Or to anyone.
Chapter 6. Roger Enright had started life as a coal miner in Pennsylvania. On his way to the millions he now owned, no one had ever helped him. That, he explained, is why no one has ever stood in my way.
A great many things and people had stood in his way, however, but he had never noticed them. Many incidents of his long career were not admired. None was whispered about. His career had been glaring and public like a billboard. He made a poor subject for blackmailers or debunking biographers. Among the wealthy, he was disliked for having become wealthy so crudely. He hated bankers, labor unions, women, evangelists, and the stock exchange. He had never bought a share of stock nor sold a share in any of his enterprises, and he owned his fortune single-handed, as simply as if he carried all his cash in his pocket. Beside his oil business, he owned a publishing house, a restaurant, a radio shop, a garage, a plant manufacturing electric refrigerators. Before each new venture, he studied the field for a long time, then proceeded to act as if he had never heard of it, upsetting all precedent. Some of his ventures were successful, others failed. He continued running them all with ferocious energy. He worked 12 hours a day. When he decided to erect a building, he spent 6 months looking for an architect. Then he hired Rourke at the end of their first interview, which lasted half an hour. Later, when the drawings were made, he gave orders to proceed with construction at once. When Rourke began to speak about the drawings, Enright interrupted him. "Don't explain. It's no use explaining abstract ideals to me. I've never had any ideals. People say I'm completely immoral. I go only by what I like. But I do know what I like." Rourke never mentioned the attempt he had made to reach Enright, nor his interview with the board's secretary. Enright learned of it somehow. Within 5 minutes, the secretary was discharged, and within 10 minutes he was walking out of the office, as ordered, in the middle of a busy day, a letter left half-typed in his machine. Rourke reopened his office, the same big room on the top of an old building. He enlarged it by the addition of an adjoining room, for the draftsmen he hired in order to keep up with the planned lightning schedule of construction. The draftsmen were young and without much experience. He had never heard of them before, and he did not ask for letters of recommendation. He chose them from among many applicants, merely by glancing at their drawings for a few minutes. In the crowded tension of the days that followed, he never spoke to them, except of their work. They felt, entering the office in the morning, that they had no private lives, no significance, and no reality, save the overwhelming reality of the broad sheets of paper on their tables. The place seemed cold and soulless, like a factory, until they looked at him. Then they thought that it was not a factory, but a furnace fed on their bodies, his own first. There were times when he remained in the office all night. They found him still working when they returned in the morning. He did not seem tired. Once he stayed there for 2 days and 2 nights in succession. On the afternoon of the third day, he fell asleep, half lying across his table. He awakened in a few hours, made no comment, and walked from one table to another to see what had been done. He made corrections, his words sounding as if nothing had interrupted a thought begun some hours ago. "You're unbearable when you're working, Howard," Austin Heller told him one evening, even though he had not spoken of his work at all. "Why?" he asked, astonished. "It's uncomfortable to be in the same room with you. Tension is contagious, you know." "What tension?" "I feel completely normal only when I'm working." "That's it. You're completely natural only when you're 1 inch from bursting into pieces. What in hell are you really made of, Howard? After all, it's only a building. It's not the combination of Holy Sacrament, Indian torture, and sexual ecstasy that you seem to make of it."
"Isn't it?"
He did not think of Dominique often, but when he did, the thought was not a sudden recollection. It was the acknowledgement of a continuous presence that needed no acknowledgement. He wanted her. He knew where to find her. He waited. It amused him to wait, because he knew that the waiting was unbearable to her. He knew that his absence bound her to him in a manner more complete and humiliating than his presence could enforce. He was giving her time to attempt an escape, in order to let her know her own helplessness when he chose to see her again. She would know that the attempt itself had been of his choice, that it had been only another form of mastery. Then she would be ready either to kill him or to come to him of her own will. The two acts would be equal in her mind. He wanted her brought to this. He waited. The construction of the Enright house was about to begin when Rourke was summoned to the office of Joel Sutton. Joel Sutton, a successful businessman, was planning the erection of a huge office building. Joel Sutton had based his success on the faculty of understanding nothing about people. He loved everybody. His love admitted no distinctions. It was a great leveler. It could hold no peaks and no hollows, as the surface of a bowl of molasses could not hold them. Joel Sutton met Rourke at a dinner given by Enright. Joel Sutton liked Rourke. He admired Rourke. He saw no difference between Rourke and anyone else. When Rourke came to his office, Joel Sutton declared, "Now, I'm not sure at all, but I thought that I might consider you for that little building I have in mind. Your Enright house is sort of peculiar, but it's attractive. All buildings are attractive. Love buildings, don't you? And Rog Enright's a very smart man, an exceedingly smart man. He coins money where nobody else would think it grew. I'll take a tip from Rog Enright any time. What's good enough for Rog Enright is good enough for me." Rourke waited for weeks after that first interview. Joel Sutton never made up his mind in a hurry. On an evening in December, Austin Heller called on Rourke without warning and declared that he must accompany him next Friday to a formal party given by Mrs. Ralston Holcomb.
"Hell no, Austin," said Rourke.
"Listen, Howard, just exactly why not? Oh, I know you hate that sort of thing, but that's not a good reason. On the other hand, I can give you many excellent ones for going. The place is a kind of house of assignation for architects, and of course you'd sell anything there is to you for a building. Oh, I know, for your kind of a building, but still, you'd sell the soul you haven't got. So can't you stand a few hours of boredom for the sake of future possibilities?"
"Certainly. Only I don't believe that this sort of thing ever leads to any possibilities."
"Will you go this time?"
"Why particularly this time?"
"Well, in the first place, that infernal pest Kiki Holcomb demands it. She spent 2 hours yesterday demanding it, made me miss a luncheon date. It spoils her reputation to have a building like the Enright House going up in town and not be able to display its architect in her salon. It's a hobby. She collects architects. She insisted that I must bring you, and I promised I would."
"What for?"
"Specifically, she's going to have Joel Sutton there next Friday. Try, if it kills you, to be nice to him. He's practically decided to give you that building, from what I hear. A little personal contact might be all that's needed to set it. He's got a lot of others after him. They'll all be there. I want you there. I want you to get that building. I don't want to hear anything about granite quarries for the next 10 years. I don't like granite quarries." Rourke sat on a table, his hands clasping the table's edge to keep himself still. He was exhausted after 14 hours spent in his office. He thought he should be exhausted, but he could not feel it. He made his shoulders sag in an effort to achieve a relaxation that would not come. His arms were tense, drawn, and one elbow shuddered in a thin, continuous quiver. His long legs were spread apart, one bent and still, with the knee resting on the table, the other hanging down straight from the hip over the table's edge, swinging impatiently. It was so difficult these days to force himself to rest. His new home was one large room in a small modern apartment house on a quiet street. He had chosen the house because it had no cornices over the windows and no paneling on the walls inside. His room contained a few pieces of simple furniture. It looked clean, vast, and empty. One expected to hear echoes from its corners. "Why not go, just once?" said Heller. "It won't be too awful. It might even amuse you. You'll see a lot of your old friends there, John Eric Snipe, Peter Keating, Guy Francone, and his daughter. You should meet his daughter. Have you ever read her stuff?"
"I'll go," said Rourke abruptly.
"You're unpredictable enough even to be sensible at times. I'll call for you at 8:30 Friday, black tie. Do you own a tux, by the way?"
"Enright made me get one."
"Enright is a very sensible man." When Heller left, Rourke remained sitting on the table for a long time. He had decided to go to the party because he knew that it would be the last of all places where Dominique could wish to meet him again.